people getting ready for the holiday season. If you have somebody who enjoys the Civil War, maybe you'd want to get them a book. This book is called After the Civil War, The Heroes, Villains, Soldiers, and Civilians Who Changed America. It's written by bestselling author and Civil War scholar James Robertson, who joins us this morning. Good morning, James. Thanks for sharing some time with us. Appreciate it.
And good morning to you, sir. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about these 70 key figures who you've kind of gone through here. Obviously, some had more importance than others. What made you decide to get to the individuals who were important after the war?
I think it was the perspective most historians have. We get to Appomattox and the end of the war, and people stop and say, okay, let's move along to something else. But Appomattox is not the end of the Civil War. It's the beginning of the end. America underwent a tremendous change in the 35 years after the war. We settled half a continent. We created a railroad empire. We became the greatest industrial power on earth. Thomas Jefferson's dream of America as a great farmland disappeared in the flames of the Civil War. We became the world leader in industry. So I took these prominent figures just thinking, well, what happened to them later on? And as I discovered on writing the book, some went up, some went down, some stepped into the spotlight, others faded into obscurity. And in each case, it was just interesting to follow their careers because no two were alike.
James, I imagine a time in which there were deep divisions, there were deep belief differences, and I also find it hard to imagine how it could all be pulled together after the Civil War, but yet it was at some point.
It was painfully, and we're still pulling a little bit, if you will. In the immediate years after the war, we underwent the most powerful, vicious political struggle in the nation's history. Lincoln had always hoped for malice toward none, charity for all, and peace, but he didn't get it. And one reason he didn't get it was his vice president was a president by accident, a Democrat in a Republican administration. Andrew Johnson had a cantankerous personality. And he got together with the radical Republicans in a head-on collision of extremists, comparatively speaking. And while Johnson wanted to follow Lincoln's lenient policy for conciliation to the South, the radical Reconstructors, the Republicans, wanted blood. They wanted revenge for the sins of secession. And so they got into a tremendous power struggle that ended up with Johnson missing impeachment by one vote. So it was a political storm taking place, and in spite of it, America was continuing to prosper. But the legacies of that storm linger on, and they linger on still. And they teach us a valuable lesson, as does the war. And that lesson is simply that only one thing holds this nation together, one thing only. And that's the willingness to compromise. You take away compromise, you take away democracy. It's the only thing.
Let's talk about some of those. Let's talk about some of those individuals. You know, we are dealing with a time when soldiers are returning from war, acclimating themselves back into civilian life. Talk about maybe the transition of some of those from the Civil War period to the Reconstruction. What did they do, and how did they adjust to not having to be in battle and have?
Well, let's take the most prominent example, the great hero of the war, U.S. Grant, deservedly so. He was the hero, and Grant expected to be president. He thought the presidency would be a fitting reward for his services. But while he became a brilliant general and remains so in annals today, he's rated as one of the worst presidents we ever had. He knew nothing about politics. He never understood the presidency. Worse, he never attempted to learn anything. So he just sat back and presided over a government, established a record for nepotism, never challenged until the Kennedys came to office. And it was his presidential years were just a disaster. But that was saved by the almost martyr-like nature of his death. He contracted throat cancer, and smoking 15 cigars a day will do it to you, I can guarantee you. And he was saved from bankruptcy by Mark Twain, who arranged for a tremendous advance if Grant would write his memoirs. And he finished his memoirs 7 days before his death in July 1885. So he had a tremendous up and down scale.
I'm looking at one woman that's featured in here. She was, you have her subtitle as a showboat spy. This is Maria Isabella Boyd. Many women
yes,
in this?
Yes, Belle Boyd was from Northern Virginia, and she was a showgirl. She was outward going. She was outspoken, doing everything a lady of that time did not do. And She married three times. She went on stage creating a drama in which she supposedly was General Stonewall Jackson's aide, which she was not. And she told this conglomeration of stories that kept an audience enraptured, but she was kind of loose with the facts, to put it mildly. Then she was giving one of those shows in Wisconsin years after the war when she died there of a heart attack, and it was the ladies of the town and the Grand Army of the Republic, the sort of American Legion of the Union side, that paid for a funeral. And this great Silene of the Shenandoah, this great Confederate spy, ends up today buried in Wisconsin.
Talk about somebody in this book that you kind of really want people to know about, somebody who's not in those history books that your other fellow Civil War writers write about, that you thought, this is somebody needs to be featured, or at least their story needs to be told.
Dr. Jonathan Letterman, very few people understood him, knew him. He was a young man raised in Frontier Outpost. In 1862, he was appointed the medical director of the North's largest army, the Army of the Potomac. He revolutionized military medicine. He created a system of ambulances, special wagons, to rush on the battlefield, gather up the wounded, get them back to first aid stations and hospital quickly, and issuing immediate first aid, which was unknown up till then. Battles up to the 1860s where you left the wounded on the fields to rot or die or whatever became of them. But Letterman got this system going, and basically he ends up as the father of EMS that we enjoy today. When you call 911, you were actually calling Jonathan Letterman. And it was Surgeon General Paul Hawley, Eisenhower's chief medical officer in Europe in World War II, who commented in 1945, every day of this war, I have thanked God for Jonathan Letterman. He's one of just the great medical pioneers of modern medicine. It was Letterman, for example, who got the novel idea that every wounded soldier should have a personal record. Today, of course, we go see our physician. He comes in the door with our records in his arm. They didn't back then, but it was Letterman who organized the medical system to what it is today.
Trying to make a little order out of the chaos that was in front of him.
Indeed.
You also talk about Matthew Brady. We know him from all these pictures that we see, but after that, what
he is the father of modern-day photography. One common mistake we need to correct. Brady took few of those pictures. He was myopic. He was almost blind from nearsightedness. He could come in a studio and make a portrait, but when he went out to Manassas to film the first battle of the war, he got hopelessly lost. He couldn't see much over 20 feet or 20 yards in front of him. But he would make millions with his photographs in the Civil War, and yet poor businessman. After the war, he struggled, and he ended up dying homeless on the streets of New York and was buried in an unmarked grave. Now, there's a guy who went from the very top of the scale to the very bottom.
Speaking of media, you also mentioned a gentleman by the name of Thomas Nast. Tell us about Thomas.
Oh, he's one of my favorites. Most people know Nast as the father of political cartoons. The cartoons you see on an editorial page originated with Nast. His pen was so vicious, it is often said that the word nasty is a reference to Nast. But he gave us something else, and we're about to celebrate it. And I don't know what American Christmas would be like without Santa Claus. And it was Nast who drew the first Santa Claus. Not St. Nicholas, not Kris Kringle, no foreign import. Santa Claus is all American. He's all us. And I sometimes think Santa Claus ought to be a national symbol. He represents all the loving and caring and sharing and giving we Americans take pride in displaying. But it was Thomas Nast who, to boost the morale of Union soldiers, created the first Santa Claus.
The book is called After the Civil War, The Heroes, Villains, Soldiers, and Civilians Who Changed America. Our guest today has been James Robertson. Thanks for sharing some of these stories, and I look forward to reading more of this book. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much.